Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Rightio, that's a funky wee intro,
cool,
isn't it?
Stand.
That's a cool sting.
Yeah,
neither have I. That's awesome. Cool. So, Marcus, we are going to be starting with pigs. Is that cool?
That's cool. Well, cool, I guess. Yeah.
So pigs' brains are being brought back to life to some sort of extent hours after death. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, sure. So this sort of revolves around the question whether brain death is really death.
Death. Yeah.
Yeah, final death. And a bit of a warning, we're going to be talking about dead animals and
yes.
a bit of dismemberment and things like that.
So be wary. That's what we're going to
go
through.
Yeah. So some of you may have seen this in the news. Researchers revived some disembodied pig brains about 4 hours after they were slaughtered. They revived them, so they saw some biological activity in these pig brains. They did not see consciousness, and they stopped short of restoring consciousness deliberately. They didn't want to make conscious pig brains there sitting on the lab bench. But it revives a lot. It's a long way from doing that, but it raises a lot of questions about ethics and about really sort of the fundamental nature of death. Because if we can start reviving things that are dead, relatively soon after their death, then we've got all these legal and medical definitions that guide protocols for resuscitating people and transplanting organs and things like that, and those will all have to be
looked at.
How did they do it? I imagine it's not like a kind of Frankenstein thing where a lever gets pulled.
Yeah, so mad scientist and lightning and big electrode. No, they. So this was published last week in Nature. They hooked the organs, sort of the brain, really, to a system that pumped in a blood substitute. That was able to restore some crucial function. So basically, they had the brain. And they connected it all up and pumped in blood or a blood substitute.
A similar way that the body would do it, right? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. And that restored some pretty crucial functions, like the ability of cells to produce energy and remove waste, and it helped maintain the brain's internal structure. So basically the brain stopped decomposing and slowly dying, and it basically started to revive a little bit.
And you said they stopped short of bringing consciousness. Does that mean they
could have? Yeah,
but they chose not to, or they could have tried?
Well, I think they were very aware of this. So they used chemicals that deliberately. So they, as well as the blood substitute, they injected chemicals that deliberately stopped neurons from firing.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
To protect them from damage, but also to protect this electrical brain activity from restarting. But despite this, they did monitor. So they were trying not to make conscious pigs. That's going to be one confused pig.
Yeah.
But even despite that, they were monitoring the electrical activity all the way through the experiment. And if they saw any sign of consciousness, any sign that the brain is regaining consciousness, they would cut it off.
So what does that obviously? This sort of experiment is being done for a particular reason. What is the hopeful outcome? Is that sort of something that they want to transfer and to be able to do with human brains? And then also, what does that mean to have a conscious brain separate to a body? How does that? Because obviously,
you
can't see anything. What does that even mean?
Very deep.
It's just so confused. I'm trying to think about it in my head going.
So how does the brain behave without any sensory input at all? I think the priority of these researchers is to find out how long they can maintain a brain's metabolic and physiological functions out of the body. And this has all sorts of implications for transplants, brain transplants, body transplants, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a long, long, long way from being used on people. not least because it's very difficult to do without actually taking the brain out of the pig in this case. Yeah.
And then what is the sort of ethical impact of it with even doing that to pigs and subjecting animals to that in the case it's happened now? Is that not surely there's an uproar in a particular community about that, not that being sort of unfair and not right to treat animals in that way?
Well, the pigs were slaughtered for meat.
For meat, right. Yeah, okay.
So there was a slaughterhouse, I think, near the lab.
Okay.
And they conveniently picked up a couple of pigs. And, 4 hours later, they were able to do this.
Okay.
Yeah. But, there's a lot of questions about how whether brain damage and brain death can be reversed, how permanent they are. So normally when people are considered brain dead, then they are dead.
Yeah.
But perhaps not, or perhaps they could be revived. And there's a lot of questions about whether that might be possible at some time in the future.
Mm. I guess it's not really scientific, but do you see maybe one day, if you're rich enough, it'll be the new kind of, what do they do now, to cryogenics or something? They all want to be frozen so they can eventually come back?
Yeah.
Will this be the new thing where they want their brain brought back?
Yeah. Put in some other body.
That's sort of the Frankenstein future, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very Frankenstein-esque. When we were reading it earlier, me and Lachlan, I said to Lachlan, I was like, gosh, it's like Frankenstein. So, yeah.
Right.
So let's move on to height. So there's been sort of studies into what, obviously, I'm sure for a very long time, about what affects height and how height is determined in people. Can you tell us a little bit about what actually determines height in humans?
Okay, so this has been, apparently, I didn't know this, but this has been a long-standing question. And it was thought, and the spoiler is it still is thought, that about 80% of variation in height is down to genetics. Okay, and there was studies on identical twins and families and things, and that was the case. But you know, we sequenced the human genome about two decades ago. But even in that time, we haven't really identified, or really found it hard to identify, what are the genes or the factors that lead to a person's height or body mass index. Yeah, and so. They needed to. So, the point of this study was to try and figure out, well, what genes or what small variants in genes are responsible for deciding height, and how much is that hereditary, or how much is that due to environmental sort of factors, nutrition and things like that. And so to seek out the genetic factors that underlie some diseases and traits like height and body mass index. Scientists often turn to sort of these big data mega searches of people's genomes, but it's very, very hard to sequence the genome of lots and lots of people, because it's a slow process, and there's just a ton of data, billions and billions of genes of base pairs, and so it's very, very difficult to do. So what these scientists in Queensland did did as many people as they could, I think about 21,000 people, 22,000 people, and they relied on sort of a principle that all people are related to some extent. So the three of us in this room were related to some extent, however far back. Yeah. and the DNA can be used to calculate the sort of degree of relatedness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah?
And so the information on people's height and body mass index could be combined with that information of relatedness to find the sort of very common and very rare changes in the DNA that could be responsible for traits like height. And so this was basically looking harder at people's genomes to figure out, because the common mutations just didn't explain it. So these are fairly rare changes in people's DNA. The spoiler is they arrived at roughly the same estimates of heritability. For height, they estimate about 79%, which is close to what they thought. For body mass index, it's only down about 40%. So if you've got a big body mass index of whatever, then your offspring might have something similar. But there's only a 40% chance that that's the case.
Mm.
Yeah.
Lachlan?
So, well, I guess we were thinking, like, you know how gymnasts are quite small? And to be a good gymnast, you have to be quite small.
Yeah. And we've heard, because I had quite a few friends that were gymnasts when they were younger, that the fact that they're under such intense, like, training and exercise that stunts their growth? Is it that sort of environmental factor that's going to affect somebody's growth, or is it, I don't know, something else? What you're eating?
I would guess the dominant factor would be nutrition, but that's only 20% of the story. So 80%, certainly for height.
Yeah.
So most of it's just you're small or you're tall.
Yeah. You're quite tall. You hit your head on the door when you're young. How tall were your parents?
They were 6 foot. My mum was about 6'5". Well, there you go. Nine, 10, something like that.
I mean, that makes sense.
And my family's all quite little. So
does that mean?
But that's I mean, I think that's well understood. We all know if parents are tall, you're probably more likely to be tall or vice versa, but it's exactly what are the underlying causes of that, and this study goes
I don't even know whether this makes any sense, but is it that there's not like a specific gene that determines what your height is? It's like factors within your genes that determines what your height is,
right? And
is
and that what it's so that they really scoured the genomes of these people, these 20,000 or whatever people, and they're looking at single letter changes in genes that commonly appear in individuals with particular diseases or that could explain a common trait such as height. And so these are rarer modifications of the genome, and they found that it's those that could possibly explain changes in height.
Oh, I see.
They found that these rare gene variants were slightly enriched in protein coding regions of the genome. So maybe sort of if you're encoding more proteins, that could lead to more growth, more height, or whatever.
Does that mean if we do start messing around with genes and things, it would be quite difficult to kind of affect someone's height if you could do that?
I think this means that it's we're closer to understanding how to affect someone's height.
Right.
Yeah.
How to make a change.
So if you are particularly small and you want to be tall or vice versa, then maybe something like this in the future could help.
Hope for you shorties out there.
And so finally, there's been a study where 3/4 of physics undergraduates experienced some form of sexual harassment in the US. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so I just want to say at the start, this story pertains to US universities, but I am... I have fairly high confidence that it very likely applies to much, much more broadly, including in New Zealand and countries similar to New Zealand and the US. So this was a survey of female undergraduates, US undergraduates, pursuing degrees in physics. And the headline is that nearly 3/4 report having experienced at least one type of sexual harassment during their science studies.
Mm.
Yeah. This was research conducted at a series of US conferences for undergraduates, and it was published last week in Physical Reviews. It's one of the first reports to document this pervasiveness of sexual harassment, and people who work in science and often in physical sciences, like myself, we've all heard anecdotal reports. But this is hard evidence of this sort of stuff. And so what they did, they recruited students who identified as female attending these conferences, and they gave them a questionnaire about sexual experiences adapted from a version that had been used in studies to assess harassment in the US military. 455 responded. 338 of them reported experiencing some sort of sexual harassment.
Mm.
Wow.
And that included gender harassment, such as being ignored because of their sex or gender, or being told inappropriate jokes, or unwanted sexual attention, touching or whatever, or a combination of that during the previous 2 years of their studies. These incidents take place in settings associated with physics, including labs, classrooms, departments, or other sort of work events. They found that the experience, those experiencing harassment, that harassment correlated with a sense of not belonging to the broader physics community, and with a feeling of succeeding because of external factors such as luck, rather than innate ability.
Because I suppose, when me and Lachlan were talking about it earlier, we were sort of saying, do you think that is surely something that'll affect whether a woman progresses further in her field or not,
or
right?
Because she even wants to,
or whether she wants to, feels like she can't. I feel like that sort of obviously the study sort of pointing to that.
Oh,
being
absolutely,
an issue.
And you know, the community believes that the progression in science should be meritorious. If you're good, you should do. You know, you should progress.
Yeah.
But this is contradicting that. I mean, if women feel like they are progressing for just because of look or because of the way they look, then it's this is not it's not meritorious.
No.
How is the sort of profession tackling this? Is there anything even at your university that maybe is focused on trying to fix this?
Honestly, as far as I know, no, there isn't. And I think it is. A very neglected area, and should, you know, all universities should have very clear policies. I don't know what AUT's policies are. I hadn't investigated that, or Auckland University's. But you know, it's something that should be out there and should be made public, and you know, the students should be aware. If something happens, you know, it's not your fault. This is something that should be reported. It will not affect your progression and things like that.
Do you think it's probably fair to say that in a lot of science-based courses, that it is often there's often a higher intake of men rather than women? And do you think that the fact that there's possibly more men in the particular faculty affects this gender inequality even more?
Look, it is complicated. And certainly, if women are seeing more men male teachers, then that might be discouraging. It's like, oh, this career path is not open to me. But also, if you know, there's many studies that show that you know, if you look at the population of high school science classes and things like that, you know, it's relatively even. And the relative participation of women in science decreases and decreases and decreases the higher up the ladder you go. So in undergraduate, sort of roughly equal, but then in graduate school it drops, and then in, you know, postdoctoral studies or career track scientists, you know, it drops and drops and drops. And it's a very complicated issue and probably should be open to a broader discussion.
Completely.
But I think this is a step towards really sort of saying this is important and pervasive.
And it needs to be addressed, yeah. Great. Thank you so much, Marcus.
No problem.
That's all we've got time for today.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. This week at the